From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Talk about a new year. In the very first week, we have an epic turnover to Democrats on Capitol Hill. The first woman Speaker of the House in the nation's history in Nancy Pelosi. A long goodbye to Saddam, goodbye to President Ford, goodbye to the country's top intelligence chief, John Negroponte, and big turnover on the way in the military's war leadership. A Navy admiral to lead two land wars, and General David Petraeus, hero of the 101st Airborne, to command in Iraq. And all these new powers will face a rugged set of challenges in Iraq, in the deficit, in the political trenches. Up next, On Point, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, John Judas of The New Republic, our own Jack Beatty, and you on the first week of a new year. We have a terrific panel with us this week. From Washington, Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, just out of the frenzy as Time moves its weekly publication date to Friday this week. Karen, thanks for being with us. Hope you got some sleep.
Thanks a lot, Tom. It's good to be here. Yes, we're all sort of Time's still trying to figure out what day of the week we're in.
But I think
it's a good move.
Bleary eyes on a new calendar. Also in Washington, John Judas, senior editor at The New Republic and visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's author of The Folly of Empire, What George W. Bush Could Learn from Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. John Judas, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, Happy New Year. Good to have you.
Happy New Year to you. Hello, Karen, and a special hello to John. Been a long time, John. Nice to have you on the show.
It's
good to have everybody here, and what a week. Crowded and a kind of culture change afoot. You know, before we get exactly into the headlines, Karen, John, and Jack, from what you've seen up in New Hampshire, not snowy New Hampshire this year, but talk to us about Washington this week. Karen, big doings. I mean, first with the assembled elites for Gerald Ford's funeral, and then this big turnover on Capitol Hill, replete with Nancy Pelosi and all the kids. We should give us a little just flavor of the Capitol this week, some snapshots maybe.
Well, I think the changeover of power on the Hill was probably what dominated the week even more than the funeral of Gerald Ford. And the many other events we seem to be having going on here. And I think it was done with a real sense of history, with a real sense of the fact that Nancy Pelosi has risen higher than any other woman in our government and in this country's 200-year history. And it was also an effort, I think, to introduce her to the public as more than a gavel, as a biography, as a mother and a grandmother and a woman who grew up in the streets of Baltimore, the daughter of a legendary mayor of that city, which was a smart thing for, I think, the Democrats to do, because what they know is that if they don't define Nancy Pelosi and who she is and what she's about now, she will be defined by the Republicans and by her opponents.
Let's listen to just a little more of Nancy Pelosi at the helm, the first female Speaker of the House in more than 200 years of American history.
Never losing faith, we waited through the many years of struggle to achieve our rights. But women weren't just waiting. Women were working. Never losing faith, we worked to redeem the promise of America that all men and women are created equal.
John Judas, give us some of the feel of this week. Did it feel like 1994 Republican Revolution Redux or something else? What snapshots are sticking with you from Washington?
Well, I have to tell you, I spent the week sitting in my office in the suburbs, which is about an hour away. So I was about as close as Jack Beatty was in Hanover to the actual proceedings. What I'd say about it is that Iraq kept intruding like the crazy ant who's kept in the closet, and intruding not only in terms of the Republicans, but in terms of the Democrats, a new House, a new Senate, but really, what can they do about the most important issue that's facing the country? And I think that's the sort of undercurrent in Washington.
And lots of moves around that on the military front. We'll look at that. And early signs that the Democrats may not be united in how to respond if President Bush proposes a surge in troops next week. Jack, I know you were watching the pomp and circumstance and change in the Capitol this week.
The change in Capitol and portents, first woman speaker, and we're facing an election campaign about to begin that'll feature a woman running for president, and that will feature a serious contender, and that will also perhaps, I would say probably, feature an African-American running for president. And this at a moment when Deval Patrick, black governor of Massachusetts, just inaugurated. So
only the second in national history, the first ever in the North, African-American state governor, yep.
That's right. So portents of change quite beyond the usual are on the menu. But I agree with John. Amidst all this change, the stasis in Iraq, and the stasis really now possibly a confrontation between Congress and the president. According to the latest CBS poll, 45% say Iraq should be the number one priority for Congress. Only the next priority is at 7%, and that's the economy of jobs. Mm-hmm. No, a disproportion unheard of. Meanwhile, you have the president is saying in the Wall Street Journal that his program and the first item on his agenda is going to be escalation in Iraq. So there you have the thing set right up, and Bush at 30% in the polls, and you alluded to it, Tom, you've got Democrats weakening on the whole idea of escalation. You've got Carl Levin saying, well, maybe if they go in.
Steny Hoyer, too, I think, the new House Majority Leader.
Right, we'll send a few in if we agree to take them out later. Well, that's sophistry. If they go in, they'll stay in. If they go in, the violence will rise. If they go in, American death tolls will rise. And if they go in, as a source, Pentagon source told NBC News, it'll be like throwing kerosene on the fire.
Well, maybe. I'm sure President Bush doesn't use the word escalation, but you can see the numbers go up there. But before the black hole of Iraq pulls us back in again, Karen, I want to stick with this change in party majority just for another minute here, because the fact is most Americans alive today have seen this very rarely. It was Democrats forever. Then it was Republicans in a huge earthquake in 94. So here we are back to Democrats. This is kind of a new rhythm for the American polity. You know, could you feel something different going on here? Are we going to get used to a more like tennis match volley in congressional majorities?
Well, the House has been far more stable. It's been 12 years since the House has changed hands. Mm-hmm. The Senate does go back and forth a lot more often. And as a result, you see a different pace in the Senate. There are also institutional reasons for this, where Nancy Pelosi is going to take the first 6 points in her agenda and just ram them through the House in her first 100 hours in office. You see Harry Reid proceeding much more cautiously in the Senate. He's formally taken over the majority, but he knows that he is not going to be able to get anything done unless he can get some Republican votes. He has a Democratic majority at this point of only one vote, and one of his guys is in the hospital. So there is a much greater sense of momentum out of the House, but I think the reality check is going to be in the Senate.
Let's hear the back and forth there. Democratic and Republican lawmakers making nice in this week. His Republican Senator, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
This opportunity we had in the old Senate chamber was a chance for many of our members to express some of their quiet frustrations that we get past the level of partisanship that we've witnessed in recent years.
And the new majority leader, Democrat Harry Reid, saying he hopes the tide has turned in Washington.
Senator McConnell and I believe this is a new day in Washington, that our efforts are going to be to work on a bipartisan basis in an open fashion to solve the problems of the American people.
John Judas, a new day or more tong wars as soon as the confetti falls?
Well, the usual strategy that an opposition party has, if they control the Congress and the other party controls the White House, is to pass things and get the other people to veto them and pass things that are popular. And I think that's the strategy that they're going to try. It's the George Mitchell strategy from 1990 to 1992. And if they can do that, then they'll be successful in putting the Republicans on the spot in the next election. I wonder whether George Bush will revert to his governorship strategy when he was in Texas and be more conciliatory, take a more compromising position. So far in his administration, except in before September 11th, he hasn't displayed that kind of political inclination. But I think that's going to be the question, what his strategy is going to be.
Karen Tumulty, what is expected from the president when on the war, and how do these changes in military leadership factor into what's coming before we turn to how the Democrats will respond?
Well, people, at this point, even the date of the speech, as far as I know, is not even clear. But everyone expects it to come at some point next week. Mm-hmm. The president will ask for additional troops in Iraq. The number that you're hearing most often right now is 20,000 over some temporary period. Again, the length of this period is a real question, whether it's going to be as little as 6 months or as long as 18 months, at which point you wonder whether it's a surge or, in fact, a true escalation of the war. And I think most importantly, the biggest onus on the president right now is going to be explaining why. What exactly are these additional troops there to do? Because the fact is, if you bring in more troops, you inevitably are looking at more casualties. And Americans are really going to want to know precisely what these troops are there to accomplish.
What is the connection, then, to bringing in these two new military leaders? Admiral Fallon, pulled out of the Pacific, put in charge of Central Command, a Navy man in charge now of overseeing two ground wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then Lieutenant General David Petraeus, very successful and much lauded with the 101st Airborne and for his early policing in Mosul. What's the significance, Karen, of these changes now? Abizaid out, Casey out, these two men in. How does it figure in?
Well, the generals at the Pentagon have not been terribly enthusiastic about the idea of a surge. And, in fact, it was already tried once before in Iraq. So part of the effort here, I think, is to get into very, very good and dynamic managers. And part of it is to bring in some people who are on board and enthusiastic about the idea of additional troops.
John Judis, President Bush has been criticized for not changing his military leadership often enough. When the war hasn't gone well, people look back and said Abe Lincoln kicked them out, peanut shells when they didn't work. Is this the change?
Yeah, I know. They're looking at the McClellan model and that one of these people might be Grant. But I think of the little I know of these military people, the one thing that stands out is the replacement of Abizaid as the head of Central Command, which is the person in charge of the Middle East and Central Asia. And he was the guy who first uttered the word civil war in connection with what was going on. And he was also the person who was cited in the Woodward book as telling John Murtha that he was holding up his hands this close to Murtha's view of the Iraq war. So
Arab-American, Arab speaker, very opposed to more troops.
I think in this case you're seeing a genuine difference of opinion. In the case of Casey, maybe more of a scapegoat, somebody who's just being place because it hasn't worked. But I think in terms of the situation on the ground, I see very little that can be done. If I had to guess what their strategy is, it would be something like trying to pacify Baghdad so that you would have some kind of central authority as the country itself began to split apart. So you could imagine some kind of federated Iraq with autonomous regions, but with a capital. And I think that may be what they're looking for by focusing on Baghdad and sending the troops there.
Hoping for. Petraeus had some success. Of course, it's years ago now in Mosul, Jack. New York Times reporting that bringing in an admiral, a Navy admiral, to Central Command may reflect a greater emphasis on countering Iranian power because, of course, that would mean naval forces and aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf. What do you see in this shakeup, Jack?
I see politics, really. NBC quotes someone at the Pentagon saying this is more of a political option than a military one. The military, if you think 20,000 troops are going to make a difference in Iraq, and of course they're going to come in stages, they're not going to be new troops, they're going to be people kept on longer, they're going to be people recycled quicker, their morale is going to be bad. If you think that's possible, I think then that's delusion. No, this is about Mr. Bush wanting to keep this disaster in the air for another year, right into the election campaign, so that he doesn't have to admit that this has been the worst failure of policy in American history. And that is what this is about. This is about him, and it's about his reputation, and his he will not admit that we have failed. We are reinforcing failure by sending these troops in.
Don't let the balloon come down on his watch, you say. Let's go to Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Ted. Ted, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
There's something going on here, and Iraq brought it out real clear. We don't have enough troops. That's why they have to keep recycling and recycling these guys over and over again. What we ought to have, and I believe this, because I was in the military when they had it, is an involuntary draft for the reserves and National Guard.
Aren't we using reserves and National Guard awfully heavily already, Ted?
Yes, but we don't have enough of them. That's the problem.
Oh, you mean so draft civilians?
When you become 18 years of age, and you, if you are physically able to do so, and that includes men and women, because there's jobs for both, and put them in the reserves.
So, that, but that would effectively be, given that that reserve pipeline is going straight to Baghdad these days, that would be a draft to support the Iraq war, and you're for it.
No, because we have a lot of other problems coming down the pike also. Look at the borders, the protection of our borders, in case of a pandemic, in case of another attack. I mean, we have to resupply these people, and the problem now is they can't train them fast enough.
Yep. Ted, it's a great point. Karen Tumwalee, let us go to you here. You know, if the country stepped up to put more people under arms and people who aren't necessarily serving now, not the profile that tends to come from lower income parts of the country and families, and along with that, others have suggested if tax rates were raised to really cover the cost of this war, what do you think would happen to public support for the Iraq war then?
Well, I'm personally of the opinion that the fact that we don't have a draft is the reason we don't see war protesters on the street constantly the way we did in Vietnam. If one reason that people, I think, have tolerated this war as long as they have is that the percentage of the population who are being affected by it directly is relatively small, and people don't really see the indirect effects. The fact that the Guard and the Reserve are now being strained so much that guardsmen and reservists are over Iraq so much that we're seeing local police forces, local firefighting forces absolutely decimated because these are often the same people.
The Army Times reporting in its recent edition that the troops themselves are now more troops disapprove of the president's handling of the war than approve it. Not a good sign, John Judas, from the front there.
Well, I was around in the 60s. I was an anti-war protester, and I agree entirely with Karen. And I think it would be a good idea for us to have a draft. It would make our foreign policy far more democratic. We have a kind of imperial foreign policy now where we send out the troops to quell the natives, and there's really no connection to the populace as a whole in terms of what these decisions are. But I don't suspect that we're going to have one. I don't think we're going to have a draft. And in the absence of that, we're going to have a much more a debate that's much more localized to the electoral arena.
We're looking at a new majority on Capitol Hill, an old war, and more challenges as well. We'll get to all of that. Let's pull back the curtain here a little further on the security front. Just this morning, President Bush formally nominated John Negroponte to be Deputy Secretary of State, number two to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. He has been Director of National Intelligence. President Bush made the announcements in a White House Roosevelt Room ceremony, noting Negroponte's service to the country.
He represented America at the United Nations. He served as our first ambassador to a free Iraq. And for nearly 2 years, John has done a superb job as America's first Director of National Intelligence. John Negroponte's broad experience, sound judgment, and expertise on Iraq and in the war on terror make him a superb choice as Deputy Secretary of State, and I look forward to working with him in this new post.
All right, Karen Tumulty, he hasn't been there all that long. General Hayden, who was there with him, gone already. This was a huge structural change in the American intelligence operation that Negroponte headed up, and now, a year and a half or so later, he's out. How do you interpret this? What's going on here?
Well, I'm hoping John or Jack can explain this one to me. This, of course, as you said, Tom, was a job that was created to solve a lot of very big structural problems in the nation's intelligence system and the, you know, problems that a lot of people thought were the reason we were vulnerable to a 9/11. And the fact that, you know, Negroponte is leaving this job so quickly to take the number two job at the State Department either says he wasn't up to the job or the job wasn't really up to what it was sold as.
John, Judas, what do you make of Negroponte? Does Condoleezza Rice need him so badly over there? It's said that he's simply doesn't really like intelligence work. He'd rather be a diplomat. But wait a minute, we've got a lot on the line here.
I think that the job just added a layer of bureaucracy and that he never had the sufficient authority to hire or fire the people who were supposedly under him or control of the budget, so that he really, what he had mostly, which was not entirely insignificant, was control over the national intelligence estimates. And the only thing we do know about Negroponte is that he is responsible for a skeptical national intelligence estimate about Iran's nuclear capabilities.
You mean he's doubting that they're so big or so close? Is that
so imminent? Yes, mm-hmm. That's right. So in that sense, he may turn out to be a loss. But I can understand somebody going from that job to second in the State Department because he'll have more authority there. Though again, you have to look at the State Department itself and the amount of authority Condoleezza Rice has over our foreign policy.
More authority
there.
That's
another problem in itself.
Even though he's been the man who's briefed the president every morning on the nation's security status. Let me take a call from Worcester, Massachusetts. Bill's on the line. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Yeah.
Just wanted to make two comments. One, that as I listen to all this, as they reshuffle the people, I'm reminded of that old phrase about rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. These people have no idea what they're doing.
Well, I mean, David Petraeus, an awfully effective general by almost all accounts. No confidence in him moving in to head the Iraq effort? He's got a pretty good record.
I think the military has proven that they're good troops and they do what they're told. I don't see that they're helping us get out of this at all. I do hope that if he does announce, as everybody expects, that he's going to put more troops in, that there'll be an outpouring of complaint from people communicating with Congress and with their representatives and such, demanding that Congress act and do something about this and get us out of Iraq. I hope that the outpouring rivals what happened with the Saturday night massacre with Nixon.
Maybe, but there's no draft, and Karen Templety thinks without it, it might not happen. Cindy Sheehan out there. Jack, let me ask you, of course, we had all the former presidents in town this week for Gerald Ford's rolling funeral, particularly at the National Cathedral there. And then these posthumous comments of Ford's coming out, tumbling out of the man in the coffin, Maureen Dowd said in the Times. He told Bob Woodward that it had been a big mistake on the part of President George W. Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld to justify the Iraq War with WMD that weren't there. Woodward quotes him saying, "I just don't think we should go hellfire damnation around the globe freeing people unless it's directly related to our own national security." A tough critique posthumously there from Gerald Ford.
Yes, and what wisdom. We shouldn't go around the world freeing people promiscuously. That isn't what the American taxpayer signed on to. That isn't certainly why the war resolution was passed. It was passed for reasons that didn't turn out, that may well have been ginned up at the least. You know, to get back to Bill's question about the troops and the escalation, John Murtha is going to start some hearings, I think next week, in which they're going to point out just how an escalation, what it will do to the Army. They're going to talk about all these matters of the recycling and so on, and what this how this will wear down the force. And Murtha is the only person I've seen, but he has clout, who's talking even about perhaps we may have to talk about restraining funds for the war, the power of the purse. And I suspect as this year goes on, the thing that Bill talks about, the pressure from the public, will be on the Congress to exercise their constitutional duty and what seems to be the will of the electorate and cut funding for this war. I think that pressure will grow.
John Judas, do you really see Democrats doing that? We can already see sort of divided opinion there. Democrats loathe to be painted as, you know, weak on security, proposing war on terror steps already in the first day in the majority? Do you see them splitting? Do you see them swinging in behind a surge? How's this going to play out politically, John?
I think they're going to criticize it. I think they might pass a resolution condemning it, but I don't think that they're going to try to cut the funds. The Democrats have been in a minority politically since 1980, partly because they Republicans got themselves the franchise as the party of national security. And I think that most Democrats are scared to death of being identified with any measure that can be described as putting our troops in peril. And you saw what happened in the 2004 election to that vote that Kerry took when he switched back and forth. So I think there will be a vocal minority among the Democrats that says we should do that, but I don't think that the leadership is going to go along with it.
Let's take a call from Somerville, Massachusetts. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi. Hello, everyone. How are you doing?
We're well. What do you see, Matt?
Well, I was interested in this story where the first Muslim member of the House of Representatives in a photo op swearing used the Koran owned by Thomas Jefferson.
This is Keith Ellison out of Minnesota.
An amazing, beautiful public relations triumph, which had so much symbolism in it. After being wildly criticized by Virgil Good, a Republican congressman, who said, I quote, "I fear that in the next century we will have many more Muslims in the United States if we do not adopt the strict immigration policies that I believe are necessary." And obviously, if you switch Muslims for Jews, you hear how racist that is. "I fear that in the next century we will have many more Jews in the United States if we do not accept the strict immigration policy." So Keith Ellison managed to find a copy of the Quran owned by Thomas Jefferson, which says so much about our founding fathers and their view of the world and their broad-mindedness and their ability to understand other peoples and other cultures.
Matt, we hear it, and it was a powerful image. Jack Beatty, there's some deep reaching back to symbolically say to the country, wait a minute, let's remember the tenor of our founding.
Yes, and how apposite, how right that Good should be from Virginia. I don't know whether I don't think he's from Charlottesville, but he's from Virginia, and of course Jefferson.
That's part of his district.
Is that part of his district?
Oh, yeah,
that is too sweet. That is just too sweet. and someone I just read this morning has scrolled on his office door or maybe the window underneath all the official titles, B-I-G-O-T, bigot. And I think that fits him very well. But, you know, the mention of Muslims, I think, we have to at least for a moment mention Jose Padilla. I think all of us were revolted earlier this week listening to Nina Totenberg's report on National Public Radio about how our government tortured this American citizen into something like insanity. In an effort to gain, well, one doesn't know. It doesn't appear that he had any information worth anything to gain. But nevertheless, he was tortured into insanity, a U.S. citizen.
Let's listen to that report. Of course, the New York Times was reporting on this. Some videotape came out. But Nina brought it to a wide audience in the ears here. Here she's describing Padilla's isolation.
For the first 2 years of his confinement, Padilla was in complete isolation, so he heard no voice except his interrogators. His 9x7 cell had nothing in it, no window, even to the corridor, no clock or watch to orient him in time. He was either in bright light for days on end or total darkness. He slept on a steel pallet, and loud noises interrupted any attempt to sleep. He had nothing to read or see. Even a mirror was taken away. And when he was transported, he was blindfolded and his ears were covered with headphones to screen out all sound. His lawyers allege that during his lengthy interrogations, he was forced into stress positions, hooded and threatened with death.
John Judas, we know that was a tough and frightened time, but this description of an American citizen, however unsavory, just you couldn't help but have your jaw drop at what could happen to a citizen.
That's right. But again, I think it's part of what happens, and it's happened continually and repeatedly in American history when we've been involved in a war that's not a war of self-defense, where we're going out and subjugating other people, and where we're in a position where we're facing some kind of insurgency. We've repeatedly resorted to torture, to these kind of atrocities that happened in the Philippines, happened in the Indian Wars, happened in Vietnam, and now it's happening again in connection with the Iraq War. And I think it's another reason to examine our foreign policy and to see if we really have, if a foreign policy really is part of our democracy or whether we have a different kind of foreign policy. Mm.
Let me go to Charlotte, North Carolina, and Craig. Hi, Craig. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're well. What do you see out there, Craig?
Well, I'm a little frustrated with the previous caller that was talking about the Thomas Jefferson's Koran.
The Koran walked over from the Library of Congress for the new congressman to be sworn in on, yes.
Right. I don't know. I mean, just because Thomas Jefferson owned a Koran doesn't mean that he believed in the Koran.
He certainly was not a Muslim, but you
right.
don't. Mm-hmm.
But what I think that a lot of times that the media does is they try to make it out like Thomas Jefferson, because he owned a Koran, then we should allow these Muslims in like this. And I don't agree with that.
When you say allow these Muslims in, what about Muslims like Keith Ellison who are fellow American citizens, born in Detroit, converted to Islam by choice? Is that not his right? And is he less entitled to a seat in Congress? Sorry?
We have freedoms here in this country, and freedom of religion is one of them. But just because we allow people to believe what they want to believe doesn't mean, because this government, this country was founded on biblical principles.
Well, it's allowed, but it's also a right, which is slightly a slightly different tone to it. But we hear you, Craig. Karen Tumulty, you hear that kind of ambivalence out there, and Craig puts it straight up.
Although I was glad that you pointed out that Keith Ellison, you know, that this should be somehow wrapped up in an immigration argument is hard to understand, because he's an American born here who is not an immigrant. And so, you know, that this was the whole sort of absurdity of Virgil Good's position from the very beginning.
John Judas, this is a conversation that won't end soon, I suppose. We've got Buddhists in this Congress, a Muslim, all kinds of religious minorities, but minorities who are very evident in American culture.
That's right. And when you go overseas, as I have during the Iraq War, and you have to constantly defend American policies to people who think that we're doing nothing right in the world, the one thing that does stand out about the United States is its pluralism and its ethnic pluralism, and the fact that we have so many people here of different nationalities and religions, and that we can't have a guy who is a Muslim who is elected to office in that manner. I mean, as far as the biblical principle I would remind the caller about is the good old Protestant principle of all people are equal in the eyes of God. And I think that did inform the Declaration's idea that all men are created equal. And I think that that's the Central American principle, and that it applies in this case to Muslims and Mormons, I should say, also, as well as Catholics, Episcopalians, Jews, and what have you, atheists too.
Right on around, and yet diversity can still stick in the cross sometimes, and you hear it there. Let's go to Warwick, Rhode Island. Jeff is calling. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
We're good. What do you think, Jeff?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment real quick on the recent talks about surging the troops in Iraq.
Yes.
At first, I wasn't for the war at all, but now that we're there, I believe it is now turned into a security issue, because if we lose this war, it's just going to make us look weak as a nation,
mm-hmm.
and that's not good for the type of enemy that we're fighting. But on top of that, I would support the surge of troops if they use them properly. If they're just going to have them sit idly and play magical chairs with all the towns and villages that they're doing now, I don't think that's going to solve anything. I think what we need to do is the same thing that we need to do in our own country, is secure the borders. I think most of the people that we're fighting are insurgents from Iran and Syria, and I don't think we're really dealing with that too much.
Well, I mean, there's many ways of looking at it. Most of what I've read recently is you've got Iraqis, Sunni and Shia, fighting each other, no doubt some foreigners as well. Karen Tumulty, you know, here's the call. We can't lose. If it takes some more troops to do something to try and hold this, pull this out, let's do it, Jeff says. Carl Levin, Democrat, Steny Hoyer, Democrat, seem to be lining up somewhere on that side of the ledger. Are you going to see support among Democrats for this?
you're going to see the Democrats divided, but quite frankly, I think the more interesting people to watch right now are the Republicans, because you're hearing some criticism from Republicans of this surge strategy, from Richard Lugar and Arlen Specter and Chuck Hagel, who's a Vietnam veteran senator from Nebraska, has described a surge as folly. I think that when you get some loud Republican voices against it, that is when you really begin to see, you know, an actual pushback on the part of Congress, because I think the Democrats are going to be too afraid of being branded weak on national security to really take the lead on this.
But if they've got Republicans at their side, perhaps they will. Let's go to Buffalo, New York. And Pat, hi, Pat, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Three things here. One is that the Democratic Congress shouldn't, you know, try to be bipartisan at all until they see what's going to come from the Republicans. The Republicans have been sticking it to them every which way they can for the last 6 years or since they took the Congress. So, you know what? It's not time to make nice. Secondly, you know, I was a Vietnam veteran, and I tried to see the Vietnamese process where they tried to shift the bulk of the fighting to the Vietnamese.
Vietnamization,
and
yes.
And you hear some talk of that now, which didn't work, and any trooper like myself who was over there could see that. And, you know, the Iraqi troops, the volunteer army, from the guys that call into this show, the army sure has dumbed down. They support this president who is not going to change his course, no matter what. The only thing they're probably going to
Well, first of all, that's not my impression of callers who call in. Secondly, the Army Times report we cited earlier says that the number, a majority of plurality, anyway, of soldiers themselves are concerned about the war strategy right now. I mean, they're watching.
More troops in, and that's what their attitude is, because I hear them. And I hear them on your show, and you ought to screen your callers better. You get too many Republicans in because they're radio nuts.
Hey, the big tent is wide open here, and we're happy for all calls, but including yours. Forget bipartisanship, says Pat in Buffalo, John Judas. And, you know, he's not alone in that. You've got the make nice folks, but also those who say it's time to move the needle, the sort of center of gravity in the country, you know, run the rewind tape here and try and pull back some of the Republican revolution. Do you see Democrats aggressively going in that direction, John?
Well, those are two different things. The swing vote in American politics is increasingly an independent vote, and it's people who want something like good government, and they don't want you can run very easily in America now against something called gridlock. So I think that I think that the Democrats would make a big mistake in mimicking the Republican Congress of Tom DeLay. And I think that they have to cultivate something like a bipartisanship in certain conspicuous ways, getting a Republican support.
Let me ask you about that, John. If they really wanted to roll back the Republican kind of reform of regulation, let's say, in government, and the taxes and the rest, wouldn't they have to use some of the hard bar tactics of DeLay? That their majorities are not that big. If they hold hands with Republicans, can they really change what Republicans wrought?
Well, they have a majority. There are still about 20 to 40 Republican moderates who are in districts that have a certain amount of Democratic support and that can be won over to this kind of legislation. There's a lot of mavericks. In the Senate, we're also talking about that there's a good number of moderates, the senators from Maine, for instance. So I think there is a lot of possibility for finding a common ground. You know, for instance, on the minimum wage legislation, there's no reason that be a solely Democratic effort. So I think that they prescription drugs also. I think they could find Republicans who are in favor of the government negotiating prices. As far as rolling anything back, they're not going to succeed in rolling back. What they can succeed in, again, is getting Bush to veto stuff.
Jack, do you see a rollback effort or kind of a little bit of treading water toward 08 and the White House run?
Probably that, and creating issues by having the president veto things. But I think that's a shame. I mean, Speaker Pelosi was right. She said they just didn't voters just didn't vote for a change in the party in Congress. They voted for a change in direction. Everything I saw that confirmed that the voters wanted a minimum wage increase. They wanted negotiated drug prices to go down. They wanted stem cells. They wanted, and above all, they wanted out from Iraq. And they certainly didn't want, 8 in 10 don't want, an escalation. Now, in the face of that kind of numbers supporting them, if the Democrats can't stand up for their for what they were elected for, they weren't just elected to be bipartisan. They were elected to follow through on what they ran on. And I would hate to say, bipartisanship is a means to an end. It can't be an end in itself. And if it is, it gets to be the president's idea of bipartisanship, which is really agree with me.
Karen Tumulty, we're almost out of time here, but this the rubber may meet the road next week. If President Bush announces he goes for the surge, Democrats will have a choice to support or oppose. You know, are we going to see that politics hit the fan 1 week from now or less?
Well, I think the thing to watch is going to be these hearings, because what the Democrats do have, they may not have the votes that they need to get things done, but they, for the first time in 12 years, have subpoena power. And they have the ability to schedule hearings, to demand that people come up and testify and explain themselves. And I think you're going to see them very aggressive in using that power.
Well, we're all ears. A new year, a new week, and a lot already afoot. I want to thank each of you for being with us today. Karen Tumulty at Time Magazine, national political correspondent there. Thank you so much for joining us, Karen.
Thank you.
John Judas, senior editor at The New Republic. John, great to have you aboard. Thanks for being here.
It was a pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, great as always. Thanks for being here, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.